This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series. Hello and welcome to Hot Pursuit, part of Ahval video and podcast series. Today I am joined by Mr. Mark Pierini, who is a former EU ambassador in Ankara and currently a visiting scholar with Carnegie Europe. Welcome, Mr. Pierini.
Thank you for having me.
Honored to have you, sir. We have now a very actual topic, actually, in the midst of the power shift having taken place in Washington, D.C., under rather worrisome, tumultuous circumstances. Now, there is a new president and vice president, Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris. Also, there are some currents happening between Turkey and European Union taking place, with sanctions looming in March. And in that frame, we have two very timely and comprehensive reports. One of them is from Center for American Progress, which was followed by a report by Carnegie Europe, penned by you and Francesco Sicardi. I have some questions coming up about this because it's a very comprehensive, very enlightening report with some recommendations, 6 points, I think. But let me begin. I must ask you this one. Today's development. Today, one of the most well-known political prisoners, Mr. Osman Kavala, and the case against Kavala and 9 other defendants in the frame of Gezi protests indictment. An appeals court overturned the acquittal decision ruling by a lower court. This indictment is interesting because it involves a lot of individuals, including yourself, mentioned by name. And this today's event, today's decision, came followed yesterday's spectacular visit by Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu in Brussels, where he, among others, met Ursula von der Leyen. And there he heard the words that, not only words, but also deeds and concrete steps should be taken. So it looks as if this was like Turkey's response to yesterday's visit and all these expectations expressed by the EU's top figures. So what is your take on this? How do you comment about this development, this most recent development?
Well, the decision and the timing of the decision couldn't be worse, basically. We're not surprised because this is what the president of Turkey said in Paris in January 2018, said in Berlin in September 2018. This is terrorism, you leave it to me. I'm resuming the situation. Mm. And basically, we cannot hope, if we look at it from a standpoint of leadership in Ankara, that Europe will change its position. Mm. Human rights are one of the core tenets of the European Union, and therefore, we are now like on a different planet. If the narrative from Ankara is, let's do trade, let's do investment, and let's cooperate in some operation within NATO, but not all. We're good guys. We can negotiate in good faith. But at the same time, day by day, week by week, the status of rule of law in Turkey goes down the drain. Well, we're not part of the same team, basically. Mm-hmm. That is the asset. And that is one compartment to which you have to add, including for the Europeans, contrary to some of the narrative, the defense architecture of Europe. Mm. Turkey has subscribed to a certain architecture within NATO years and years ago, and then wrecked it by purchasing and deploying S-400 missiles. For a long time, European governments have left this to the US government. And of course, for the past 4 years, we've had virtually no dialogue between the US president and his European counterparts. And with all the differences we know about Syria, about other subjects. But basically, what we have now is a situation where Turkey has hampered the architecture for the defense of Europe, is perceived as very unlikely to go back to a purely NATO posture. So Europeans have to worry about that. And we're now in a very different situation since 2 days ago, that we are going to have a real dialogue between the Biden administration and the EU institutions, the administrations in Berlin, Paris, and so on. Mm-hmm. So that confident dialogue will resume, and the unpredictability of the Trump administration has gone away, and the friendship, or whatever you want to call it, between Donald Trump and the president of Turkey, that's finished.
That's exactly what an analyst expressed to me in terms of no more free rides for Turkish administration. So the title of your report is Why the EU, European Union, and the United States Should Rethink Their Turkey Policies in 2021. So, and also it goes to say that the EU and US must protect their interests by containing Turkey's disruptive behavior, Turkey meaning Erdogan administration's disruptive behavior, while maintaining economic and security ties. And also, I think it's interesting, 2020, you write, sort of was a watershed for Turkey's relations with its allies and partners. How was it so? How was it so defining?
Well, it wasn't the first time that you had very serious incidents between Turkey and the EU. You had that repeatedly in 2017 in the context of the referendum. And remember that German politicians and Dutch politicians were Nazis or Nazi remnants and so on. So these episodes have occurred before. Last year is a watershed for several reasons piling up. One is that the narrative came back. Nazis, once again, mental health, get rid of this president, etc. Not something that you would expect from a neighbor. Less so if the neighbor suddenly tells you that Europe is central to its policy and NATO as well. That's one thing. But 2020 is also the year where the S-400 missiles were tested. That is virtually deployed, and not only deployed, but the narrative was by the defense minister and others that there was no way back, and perhaps there was another purchase coming up for a second battery. So that is the fundamental disruption, mm-hmm. because basically Turkey has given all the signs, verbal signs, that and also, you know, engagement in some joint maneuvers and so on in the Black Sea and elsewhere, that Turkey is committed to NATO. At the same time, if you look at the embargo on arms deliveries to Libya, Turkey has been with NATO or without NATO, depending on the interest. So this is what created the uncertainty. There was incidents, repeated incidents on the embargo with Italian, Greek, French, and German frigates. That's a lot. With, you know, a very eruptive narrative around these incidents, at least some of them with the French and the German. But basically, you cannot be in NATO on and off depending on the domestic political, you know, scenery. So that is the real disruption.
Mm-hmm. That also includes the tension in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Of course.
The declaration and deepening of the Blue Homeland Doctrine, which was partly designed by the former officers. And this also led to a lot of discussions and tension between particularly France and Turkey, but also discussions about the territorial integrity of the European.
But on this point, there is another worrying sign, if you want, or absence of reaction. Remember the October 1st European Council, there was an offer to come and sit at the table.
You mentioned
this
that in the report.
Was not followed up by Turkey, which raises an interesting question. Is the pressure from the domestic political scene, and of course the pressure from the Nationalist Party allied with the AKP, such that tension is a more important ingredient with Europe than compromise? And that is the essence of the current discussion. Of course, the DNA of Europe is dialogue, compromise, never again a conflict. But who is sure today that tension is not more profitable domestically in Turkey than dialogue and compromise? We don't know, and that's part of the, you know, watershed year in 2020.
Mm-hmm. And also constellation of power in Ankara is quite puzzling, actually, how the decision-making processes have been happening. It is very hard to figure out, even for us journalists who talk to different sources. We hear very sometimes conflicting narratives about who is in charge, really, in Ankara, about these kind of, you know, major national security and diplomacy decisions. It's very difficult.
On this, if I may have a comment, I think obviously the fate of the next elections, if they take place, is in the hands of the citizens of Turkey.
You are very cautious about that, if they take place.
Yeah, I've been cautious about that for several months now.
Yes.
So that's in the hands of the citizens of Turkey. Fine. What is not credible for European politicians, even more importantly, members of parliaments in Germany, in France, in the Netherlands, etc., and the European Parliament, obviously, is that in a couple of weeks in November, you switch from the ultimate insults to European leaders to a sort of proclamation of you know, unity with Europe and NATO and so on.
Olive branches, these, basically.
These U-turns, you can explain them at least as foreign observers, you know, yabancis. You can explain them by the twists and turns of domestic policy. You can explain it also by the fact that an ally was lost in Washington and somebody else is now in power. But at the same time, it wrecks the credibility of the political narrative. Mm. And that's one of the difficulties we're facing now.
There are various, a handful of people talking to EU, actually. One is, of course, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And we know, we have experienced what kind of language he uses. But also, there are other figures like Chief Advisor Ibrahim Kalın, Defense Minister Hulusi Akar, and Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, Foreign Minister. These are the, you know, major figures. Who is being taken seriously in the EU? Because I am sure there is some sort of extinguishing fire type of work also with this fiery rhetoric that is unleashed over the EU figures and countries, etc. Is there anyone among them being taken very seriously or seen as moderate figure, etc.?
I don't think so. Of course, talking to one of these three persons you mentioned, one I know and I saw a few times when I was ambassador, Ibrahim Kalın. If I judge, for example, by his visit here to Brussels and the talks he had and video conference he had with GMF, the language is absolutely polished, perfect. The problem is that you have a perfectly autocratic system of government in Turkey. So do you think a German chancellor, a French president, or the prime minister of any other EU country, those sitting in the around the European Council table, do you think they're going to believe the foreign minister, the defense minister, or the presidential advisor, or the president? Basically, they're going to trust the president. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, you'd have to have a massive leap of faith to believe the recent U-turn and for example, the discussion between the president and the EU ambassadors. It was not a discussion, actually. It was a speech. But I mean, you think that you are in a different planet. But embassies, what do? On a daily basis? They analyze the economic situation. They analyze the human rights situation. They analyze the political discourse between opposition and government. They analyze the tensions within the governing coalition, and they're not too reassured. And they see that these tensions somehow, I think it's a mistaken course, but never mind, this is what's happening, is leading to a reinforcement of the hostile narrative with Turkey and, of course, a further degradation of rule of law. As I said earlier, week by week, month by month. So, you know, how do you make a real U-turn? You can make a real U-turn in a letter or in a speech. That's fine. Easy. How do you make a real U-turn in deeds? Can you think of any mechanism by which the judiciary would become fully independent? Mechanism or a political narrative by which Demirtas would be back in politics? Kavala, Altan, Ilacak, and others would be out of. And even by saying so, this is very unfair because we're talking of a handful of people, but you have 60 or 70,000 in jail. So that, you know, conversion of the Turkish leadership to real reforms and the willingness to accept real gestures, goodwill gestures in the field of human rights, that is now a crucial ingredient. You've seen that in the debate in the European Parliament yesterday. And there's no amount of nice narrative that is going to change that. You need to have decisions. And mind you, the novelty for the past 2 days is that the US president is now on the same line. That's new for Turkey, fundamentally new.
Right. You mentioned, and I meant to ask you this since it came up, I will ask you. You mentioned those who are purged after the attempted coup, some 125,000. But interestingly, you mentioned the figure 70,000 in detention, either sentenced or in detention. Pretrial detention. I know that Human Rights Watch mentions about 50,000, and they are political prisoners, more or less, defined as such. And now it's 70,000. It's a very high figure. It's an incredibly high figure. I think you refer it to Freedom House, right? Freedom House.
Yeah. Mm. Whether it's 50 or 70,000, the figure is staggering, number one. Number two, in a number of cases that have been through the European Courts of Human Rights, you have a case of abusive detention, okay? So Turkey is a member. Turkey is committed to the Council of Europe. Therefore, Turkey, so far, has refused to free these people pending trial. Okay, that's one thing. At the same time, you don't see the bottom of it. Everybody knows that in November 2002, the elections were won by the AKP thanks to a coalition with the Gulen movement. Mm-hmm. Then in a number of ministries, administrations, and so on, the Gulen movement inserted a number of people. Fine. I mean, this is Turkish thing. Now, since the aborted coup, it has been decided that this will be overturned, but we don't see the end of it. How can you manage the country on the basis of permanent suspicion with everybody? Yeah. And I'm not talking just of the suffering of the citizens of Turkey involved there. I'm talking of the diffidence that it introduces with bankers, investors from Europe who want genuinely to cooperate with Turkey, to invest in Turkey. But what they see is that it is a politicized judiciary. And what you mentioned at the beginning, the Court of Appeal for Osman Kavala. You know, imagine the impact of this decision. You know, you have an acquittal. The prosecutor of the time, who is now a deputy justice minister, said, we're going to appeal that. Well, it's been appealed, and now it's overturned. If you are about to invest 50 or 100 million euros in a plant in Bursa, I'm saying Bursa because of the automotive industry, obviously, very popular place with European automotive sector. Well, you have to be worried. If you're a banker, well, if you're doing short-term lending and so on, you're playing on risk and premiums and so on, you may manage. But if you're a long-term investor, this is devastating news, you know. And not only it is devastating for Osman Kavala, his family, his friends, and other people like him, but it is devastating for those who want to have a decent economic relationship with Turkey.
Mm-hmm. I understand. And indeed, this pattern is very clear, as you mentioned in the report, that ongoing collective arrests that keep happening and endlessly without losing any pace. Some days ago, a large group of officers, I think in North Cyprus and in Western Europe, Anatolia, were arrested. And I think today, last night, some judges and prosecutors. So this is uninterrupted, basically. In your report, let's stay at domestic politics. You make a linkage between Turkish foreign policy's disruptiveness to domestic politics, rooted as there. And also you mention AKP rule as from the very beginning, based on and aimed at and moving on upon a ballot box legitimacy. It wasn't simply that, was it? I mean, between 2002 and 2008, roughly, and you were there, there were large number of reforms that the parliament, with the backing, slight backing of main opposition even sometimes, passed. And tens and maybe, you know, more than 300 reforms, EU reforms passed. So it's there as a fact. It's not only ballot box legitimacy, but those reforms pushed Turkey forward. But something somewhere went wrong. What went wrong?
Well, as you said, this is domestic politics. So who am I to make a call on this? But I think to me, whether the commitment of the Turkish leadership to reforms towards accession to the EU was sincere, long-lasting or not, I will not discuss that. But you're absolutely right. A number of reforms occurred, quite a few of them, of course, supported by the EU financially through the IPA program. And I managed a huge amount of projects at any given point in time. It was like 350 projects alive, including some, you know, with security forces, human rights, and so on. I think Once it became clear that with the political support of the European Union, the army had no more political power, then the usefulness of the accession process was much lower.
Began to fade, basically.
Yeah, began to fade for a leadership that, in any case, view its legitimacy in the ballot box. For me, the vivid example is the municipal campaign in 2019. This was fought by the president of Turkey himself, and this was not a referendum for him. It was not a presidential election, but he did up to 8 meetings, rallies, every day. So it was considered by the top of the state as a sort of referendum. And this is why the result was, of course, so painful for the leadership. And also, seen from a Western country, it was reassuring in the sense that people voted, you know, against the leadership in a way. So that is the very difficult part of the debate for Europeans. If today, let's say today after the visit of the foreign minister, you are a foreign minister, or you are in the Commission or the External Service or the European Council's diplomatic team, and you want to believe that there is an avenue towards progress, basically you cannot forget that. You had a commitment towards Europe, you don't have it anymore. Who can believe that the political norms of the European Union would be compatible with the current political architecture in Turkey? Nobody believes that. Then, if you want to believe that there will be some return to reforms, well, we want to see a return to an independent judiciary, for example. Okay, but the minute you say that, and this was said in the meetings yesterday, of course, in the Commission, in the Expert Service, in the Parliament, the minute you say that, you have a decision by a court of appeal on Osman Kavala that goes the other way. So it seems to be a constant debate in Ankara between what you want to do to sort of patch up with Europe and what you basically want to do for domestic political reasons. And that's, you know, the tragedy of the current situation.
Very well put indeed. This is also expressed by another analyst. I think it was former MP Haluk Özdalga, who mentioned in one of our interviews, said that the Erdogan administration is stuck. If it continues on the reform path, it will, at the end of the day, fade. Its power will fade. If it doesn't do that, if it defies on the reform, going into reform path, the same will happen. So I think it's sort of an impasse, to use a French term, and this is where they are.
If I may add one other remark there, is that because of domestic political considerations, Turkey's actions on the foreign front, maritime boundaries, Syria, Libya, Nagorno-Karabakh, and I'm not talking about Cyprus yet, they were all done because these were long, but maybe let's leave Libya outside, but take maritime boundaries, protecting against the PKK and Nagorno-Karabakh and Azerbaijan, if you want. These are consensual subjects in Turkey. You know, most opposition parties, not all, but most, sort of approved of that. They may not have approved, or they may not see the damage done by the methodology which was followed. You know, remember, mid-August, we nearly lost 2 frigates at sea, 1 Turkish, 1 Greek.
Right.
And these are 2 NATO countries. We know they disagree on a number of points, but getting to the point that you have one cutting off the other you're risking a major tragedy there with dozens or hundreds of casualties. So that is the element that is very difficult to comprehend. But other than that, you are probably true. There is a very difficult domestic political situation there.
Now that you mentioned it, should one expect any progress at all, tangible progress at all in exploratory talks? Greeks want to remain optimistic given their position. And also, what should one expect with these kind of two-state solution messages coming from the newly elected North Cyprus leader, Mr. Ersin Tatar?
Yeah, well, on the Greece-Turkey talks, basically, we know that there is a relatively less difficult element, which is the one maritime boundaries between Rhodes and Crete on the one hand and Cyprus on the other. Okay, this Castello Rizzo thing is recognized as being an anomaly by many European countries, by experts, by academics, by lawyers. And we know that elsewhere in the world, including in far-flung places involving EU member states, I'm talking here of Saint-Pierre and Miquelon, this French, very small French territory on the eastern coast of Canada, there are solutions. Okay? The difficulty is that we've heard many times that Turkey doesn't want to discuss just maritime boundaries, but a number of other things, including some elements of the Lausanne Treaty. So that is the difficulty for next week. And basically, you're going back to the same issue. Do you want a compromise now on just maritime boundaries? Because this is what you have on the plate. And you know, if you're in Ankara, you know that member states other than Greece will support Greece to move to a compromise. Or do you want the maximalist debate on everything, including maritime boundaries, but much bigger? Or basically, to come back to my earlier formulation, do you want compromise or do you want to keep going with tensions? And once again, this is the way the debate appears. Now, on the two-state solution, we've heard not only the new president of Northern Cyprus, but also the leadership in Turkey saying two-state is obsolete. We now,
the one-state
comprehensive settlement is obsolete. We're moving to two-state. Well, basically, trying to impose a solution against the grain of the discussions so far. One can complain, of course, that it has taken ages to move forward, then get stuck, then start again, then get stuck again. We know that. But basically, a two-state solution is just another provocation that will not improve Turkey's image, in my view.
Also, this makes the recent Erdogan proposal on Mediterranean conference, because again there will be huge difficulties there, because Turkey doesn't recognize Republic of Cyprus, and also European Union as you mentioned it in the report, I think in some part EU would be very reluctant to join such a conference because of the North Cyprus issue. So it looks like or sounds like a non-starter.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want to be optimistic beyond reason, you'd say, well, if such a conference occurs, it means Turkey will have de facto recognized the Republic of Cyprus, it means the EU will have de facto accepted that there is a Northern Cyprus entity, not calling it a republic. Mm. But that's not in the cards, neither one nor the other. So what do you do? We understand the claim in Ankara on behalf of the Turkish Cypriots about resources and so on, But I don't think the methodology which has been followed so far, which is essentially made of provocation, useful provocation on the domestic scene, I recognize that. And of course, all politics are local, we know that. But, you know, doesn't help. So I don't know where we're going that.
I have two or three more questions before we conclude. I think one point is important. I want to hear your comment about that. Assertive foreign policy. This is a term that we hear often. Sometimes offensive foreign policy. Some say aggressive foreign policy regarding Turkey's moves in the region. Expansionism, irredentism, all these things. But I think one important aspect that I think you touch upon in the report is how, you know, solidly, firmly Turkish low-scale, small-scale or mid-scale producers are being drawn into a militarized industry or defense parts, etc., etc. Is that something that that West European Union should pay more attention to?
Well, I suppose the...
I'm asking because you're an expert on defense issues and weapons, etc.
We would hope that the defense attachés in European embassies have noticed this well before today, obviously. But it is a fact that a large program of building up Turkey's defense industry has been put in place a long time ago, producing its effects now. Turkey is not yet autonomous, of course, depends on a German engine and transmission for the Altai tanks and French armor or systems. Six submarines being built depending on German engines, etc., etc. Drones, a very brilliant operation, including now high-altitude, long-endurance drones, which, after all, are only produced in the world by the US, Israel, and China. Now, the fourth one is Turkey. So it is obviously an achievement. And even, as I wrote in the report, a game-changer that gave Turkey a bigger place in the regional context. It was not only a military game changer, but a political game changer. That's all fine. Then some sanctions have been put in place, not so only EU, but Canada as well. More sanctions are possible. But of course, Turkey will find domestic solutions or solutions with Ukraine, South Korea, or what?
Italy and Spain?
Well, Turkey can hope to divide member states on this. But, you know, with Spain in the military sector, well, the helicopter carrier Anadolu is nearly completed. So there's no amount of sanction that would hamper that. And the biggest sanction on the Anadolu is not the vessel itself, is the fact that Turkey is out of the F-35 program and was about to buy the F-35B, which would have been a game changer because would have been able to take off and land on the Anadolu. That's not possible. And there is no other machine of that type that can be used on the Anadolu. So basically the Anadolu is back to attack helicopters, transport helicopters, amphibious vessels, and possibly some of the drones. But, you know, there, Turkey basically has sort of self-inflicted sanctions to itself, okay, through S-400 F-35 connection. So there is progress there. The issue is not just the hardware. The issue is basically what you do with all this. Okay. And therefore, I think, and this is what I mentioned in the report, I think this important I would even say impressive reinforcement of the military arsenal of Turkey through primarily domestic means is a new factor in a political context where Turkey has been more often than not playing in favor, directly or indirectly, of Russian political objectives. Okay, certainly the S-400 is the case in point. Okay, you sort of wreck the harmony of the NATO missile defense system for Europe. That's one. But if you look at Nagorno-Karabakh, yes, it's in favor of Azerbaijan, but basically it's also in favor of Russia. And if you look at the way the airbase near Latakia in Syria is used, Haymim, okay, it's been used in the campaign in Syria for purposes, bombing hospitals and schools, and what else, that Turkey doesn't agree with, but it's been used for that. Through what? Through a resupply chain from bases around Moscow with direct overflight rights over Anatolia. What is this, if not facilitating Russia's policy? And that's only Syria. But if you look now at what Russia is going to do with Sudan, with perhaps a base on the Red Sea, is about to do with Libya, with an air base, more or less under control, perhaps a seaport, what Russia is doing in Central Africa. So all of this is done through the Air Force base in Haman, with overflight rights over Anatolia. Nobody says that, but you're saving the Russian Air Force hours and hours of flights to these destinations. So essentially, these overflight rights are a facilitating device in favor of Russia. And now, if you look at it from Brussels, NATO more than EU, obviously, what you're seeing is not just that Turkey is a bigger actor in the Eastern Mediterranean and wants a permanent base in Western Libya and a seaport too. That's one thing. But in its wake, you have Russia coming. Of course, as a kind of counter element, sort of balancing Turkey, but basically seen from Europe, you have two worrying factors for the price of one. Okay.
And, I see.
I add a last element, not a detail, that Turkey has imported, quote unquote, Syrian jihadists in Western Libya. Where do these guys go?
Everyone is wondering about that, yes.
Yeah.
One question, and that will lead us to final conclusion about your six recommendation points. It is this. I think three major developments defined Turkey's relations with the European Union in the past four or five years. One was the attempted coup, whose background is still unclear because ruling party AKP covered up the parliamentary report, commission report, which we still don't have access to. And opposition had some dissent about that. That is aside, we had a nightmarish state of emergency in the wake of the attempted coup, which led to enormous purge and suffering and also brain drain. And tarnished academia, further damaged the media, which is almost nearly entirely under control of the power, and the referendum 2017, which turned, which brought Turkey into a sort of a super presidential system, one-man rule in terms of a simple explanation. And under these conditions, of course, one questions whether or not accession process to European Union is at all realistic or not, after all these things. Copenhagen criteria is not to speak of. So we still, despite that fact, keep hearing still talk about negotiations, accession negotiations. We keep hearing about visa liberalization. We keep hearing about revision of customs union. In of course, in these discussions, the people of Turkey and its aspirations is not mentioned as much as it should, almost never. So what is your view about whether or not visa liberalization, whether or not these, the revision of customs union, etc., are they any more realistic, or is the accession process dead and over?
I would say that if we look carefully at the architecture of power in Turkey right now, stemming from the new constitution, but also stemming from day-to-day management of governance, and of course the status of rule of law and the treatment of human rights defenders and so on and so forth, media, justice, accession process is over. If the commission was starting afresh today and was to write a report, do we grant negotiating status to Turkey on the basis of the Copenhagen criteria? The answer would clearly be no. There's no, absolutely no doubt about it. There's no basis. And my own analysis is that abiding by European criteria, political criteria, despite all the narrative that we've heard, including yesterday in Brussels, that's the last thing the Turkish leadership wants, because it's absolutely the opposite of what they have constructed through the referendum and the presidential election. So it's just, it's not even a fake narrative. It's a trap in terms of who wants to believe it, come here and we'll talk. But basically, it's not going to happen. Whether the European governments will have the unanimity to declare the accession process dead or not, that we're not there yet. But that in any way, a no-go. That's one thing. Then visa liberalization. When you hear the official narrative, you hear that, well, there are 72 criteria. We're nearly there. There are only a handful left. Well, it's just that there is the security law, the anti-terrorism law, and that is not going to change, in my view. The odds of changing that law are very, very slim. And therefore, yes, you may have completed 67 or 68 criteria out of 72, but the fundamental one is not there. So we're not going to go anywhere there. Now, we can have progress on a limited basis. We can have, under a certain constellation of stars, progress on the customs union if there is progress on the judiciary. Because, you know, from a European point of view, there is no difference between the absurd way somebody like Osman Kavala is treated by the Turkish judiciary and the way in which Siemens, Bosch, or Renault would be treated in court. Okay? So it's all the same thing. You know, can we trust? Can we be at home? Can we feel at home there? And remember how in October and November, Volkswagen said, we're putting on the back burner our 1.3 billion euro investment in Manisa to produce the Passat and the Skoda Superb. Was later cancelled entirely under the guise of COVID and economic recession. But basically, what you've seen in October and November is twice a statement by the CEO of Volkswagen saying, I'm not investing in a country operating under these conditions. And one statement from the trade union, the major trade union there, saying, we're not going there because of human rights. So this is the kind of damage that Turkey is inflicting itself upon itself. Now, again, if there is a measure of progress, customs union might move forward, but it's going to take a long negotiation.
Unanimous decision?
Well, that will be under discussion. It is a community matter, yes. Maritime boundaries, assuming that we can, for the time being, isolate maritime boundaries from the rest of the Turkish claims on Greece, that could move forward. And of course, I've advocated for this for 2 to 3 years now, renewing the refugees support, Syrian refugees in Turkey and Syrian displaced person in Idlib. That is something that is within the cards. Of course, we know the political narrative would be, well, we haven't seen the money. Yeah. We haven't seen the money is what we've heard on a weekly basis, except that Turkey has seen 6.5 billion, because it was six, but it became 6.5, nearly 6.5. And it's working extremely well. If you talk to, you know, AFAD, the Red Crescent, the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Health, they're all very happy about it. So this can happen again. It would be better if it happened without the "we haven't seen the money" narrative, but okay, that can work for obvious reasons. And it's not peanuts, contrary to what the official narrative says. You may know that European officials, not people like me, but people in the Commission. Have asked many times for the details of the Turkish expenditure on Syrian refugees and never got it. But all the same, they can produce a new plan. It's not, you know, rocket science, and it would help lower the human suffering in Turkey, and will help integrate these refugees to the Turkish society. And it would, of course, lower the human suffering in the Idlib province, where you have other risks, obviously, because of the military operations.
So we come to the final point. And this is, I think, a watershed where we find ourselves observing these relations between Turkey and the European Union, where accession process is over. It's dead and nearly buried, but a new format is taking shape. Maybe sort of at best, perhaps a privileged partnership, but transactional partnership, most realistically speaking. You come to the conclusion that there are clearly clashes between the interests of Erdogan government. Not necessarily Turkey, but the interests of European Union and US. So you recommend 6 steps for a rethink, which I think, as I said in the beginning, is overlapping with the Center for American Progress report to in major parts. What are those points? Please enlighten us about them.
Very simply, the first one is already happening for the past 2 days. It is US-EU consultation. You know, this will happen at several levels, State Department, National Security Council, and so on. But that's not a surprise. I mean, it was part of the European Council conclusion on December 11, if you remember. We welcome the reception of that. And it's not only about Turkey, obviously. It's about a lot of other things, you know, climate change and Iran and relations with Russia and so on. So this is happening, and you have extremely well, you have experts in the NSC and the State Department and the CIA, extremely well versed into Turkish matters and into EU matters. So you can be confident that this dialogue will take place. I'm not saying here that all EU-US matters will be resolved all by miracle. Of course, there will be trade disputes and so on and so forth. But as far as Turkey is concerned, they're going to look at, for example, human rights issues, defense issues, in very much the same way. Of course, the US is more remote, doesn't have to suffer from, you know, the economic downturns in Turkey or a refugee wave, but they do care about these things. So the nightmare and I'm using the proper word here, of the Trump era for European politicians is over. They know they have someone to talk to. And the someone is not just the president himself. It's all the different layers,
lower levels
of power. Then, in my view, one of the first debates that will come up will be defense, security of Europe, and of course, the S-400 thing. So far, perhaps European governments were all too happy to leave that to the US administration, all the more so that they couldn't understand Donald Trump. And perhaps in the Pentagon, they could not either. But, you know, that's over too. They're going to talk to real people who know that S-400s are basically a threat to European defense, to European security.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, these are oversized systems directed at what kind of threat? You know, the biggest missile arsenal are Iran and Israel. But Turkey is allied with Iran in the Astana process.
Okay.
Who believes Israel would try to assault Turkey with missiles? Doesn't make any sense. The other S-400 missiles you have are in Latakia, and they're Russian.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, basically, in the very difficult times post-coup, let's say in August 2016, Turkey was offered a very smart deal by Russia, by these missiles, but that's not what Turkey needed at that time. So now, basically, we're faced with a sort of brilliant coup by Russia, implanting at the heart of a major NATO air force, Turkish air force, a huge and sophisticated missile defense system. And there is no amount of technical committees and this and that will solve that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's easy to say that. It's less easy, a lot less easy to see what's next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but
sure.
Then we've discussed the European part of my recommendations. I think you know, we know what is doable, what is not. Where I am more puzzled is with rule of law, because it's one of my recommendations, obviously, and.
This is the recommendation number 5, I think.
Yeah. What you have here is a almost total disconnect between Ankara and Brussels, or Ankara and the capitals in Europe.
And also European Court.
Yeah. And Council of Europe, yeah. That obviously Turkey would want a deal that is about trade, investments, and visas, and no human rights. Okay. Well, mind you, this is not the way our political societies work, period. You know, if you listen to the debate yesterday in European Parliament, which was essentially about Demirtas, but also about Kavala and more generally about the situation, if you listen to the meeting, well, you don't listen because it's not public, but you can easily imagine the discussion between the foreign minister of Turkey and the Turkey rapporteur, Nacho Sanchez Amo,
mm-hmm.
Yesterday or this morning, I forgot. Well, basically, you're not on the same page. Okay. The formal statement by Borrell, read by another commissioner, Dali, in the European Parliament, is very clear about, you know, words are words and deeds are what we need. And mind you, even if one of the non-elected officials in the EU system wanted to skip these words, well, these officials, Commission President, the President of the European Council, the High Representative, they are accountable to the European Parliament. So there's no escape there. You know, the European Parliament and many national parliaments are not going to allow major progress with Turkey without some change on human rights, on rule of law. Mm-hmm. You know, because this is the nature of our democratic societies, period.
Yet you somehow express cautious hope that Turkey under this government may return to rule of law. But the history tells us and teaches us that no autocratic regime has turned back and towards normalization or democratization. There's no example of
yeah.
that.
No, don't misunderstand me. I'm not expressing personal hope as an analyst. Mm. You know, I work for no institution. I'm paid by nobody, so I'm doing all of this on my own voluntary basis, and I have the stamp of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. But what I'm saying is that I can easily imagine that some European governments might be tempted, cynically or not, or naively, but perhaps more cynically than naively, to believe the narrative, to entertain the narrative that reform is around the corner, okay? For the sake of no more conflict, and perhaps we can sort of manage. I don't think it will work with elected members of parliament, European Parliament, National Parliament, and I don't think it will lead to harmonious discussion with the United States. So as much as I would want to believe that, I don't see it happening, because it's just too far from reality.
Right. I think there were divisions, and what's commendable about your approach and your report is that there were these divisions between those who promote appeasement and those who promote realism under these circumstances, and you belong certainly to the second camp, realists and sharp observers. And we'll see where things lead us now, Mr. Pierini. And we will see it sooner than later, I think, with the entry to the stage of the Biden administration and its actors. Thank you for this wonderful conversation. You shed a lot of light on the issues in a large, broad spectrum. My guest in Ahval Hak Pursuit was Mr. Mark Pierini, former ambassador of the European Union in Ankara and visiting scholar with Carnegie Europe. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.